listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
A Canadian court granted bail to a senior executive of China's Huawei Technologies 10 days after she was detained in Vancouver on a U.S. arrest warrant, triggering a major diplomatic row. Huawei's chief financial officer, Meng Wanzhou, who's the daughter of its founder, faces U.S. claims that her company bypassed Washington's anti-Iran sanctions. Those sanctions were the subject of a discussion at the U.N. Security Council on Wednesday. Fazad Hassanpour filed this report for Iran's Press TV.
Since U.S. President Donald Trump pulled out of the 2015 Iran nuclear deal in May, Europe has repeatedly pledged to take action to neutralize the consequences of Washington's withdrawal. Trump's decision was followed by the reimposition of anti-Iran sanctions, which had been lifted under the nuclear agreement, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA. The European Union intends to establish a system to facilitate non-dollar trade with the Islamic Republic and bypass U.S. sanctions. It funds the so-called Special Purpose Vehicle, SPV, trade mechanism to help preserve the economic benefits for Tehran deriving from the curbs it put on its nuclear program under the JCPOA. On Monday, the EU foreign policy chief said the SPV could be in place by the year end.
I would expect this instrument to be established in the coming weeks, so before the end of the year, as a way to protect and to promote a legitimate business with Iran.
Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif says the European Union's offers to save the JCPOA have failed so far to meet the country's expectations, but the Islamic Republic has remained committed to the JCPOA, giving Europe an opportunity to fulfill its promises to save Iran's interests under the the accord. Iran's deputy foreign minister Abbas Araghchi has, however, warned that Tehran could not wait forever to reap the economic benefits of the deal. Now the ball is in Europe's court to practically fulfill its pledges regarding the implementation of the JCPOA, as Iran has warned it could ditch the nuclear deal if EU powers do not protect its trade and financial interests.
Those sanctions were before the UN Security Council Wednesday, where U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and Iran's Deputy Permanent Representative exchanged their points of view. This was U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo.
Just 2 days ago, the head of the IRGC's airspace division, Amir Adizadeh, boasted that Iran is capable of building missiles with a range beyond 2,000 kilometers. He said, quote, "We have the ability to build missiles with broader ranges. We don't have limitations from a technical perspective." End of quote. He also said there are many enemy bases within 800 kilometers of Iran. In other words, within striking distance of Iranian missiles. He bragged that Iran does 40 to 50 tests per year. As I'll talk about further, it is clear that the Iranian regime's ballistic missile activity has grown since the nuclear deal. Iran has exploited the goodwill of nations and defied multiple Security Council resolutions in its quest for a robust ballistic missile force. The United States will never stand for this. No nation that seeks peace and prosperity in the Middle East should either. Since 2006, this council has been telling Iran to stop testing and proliferating ballistic missiles in one form or another. From 2010 to 2015, Iran was subject to UN Security Council Resolution 1929, the strictest resolution addressing the Iranian ballistic missiles to date. In that resolution, the Security Council decided that Iran shall not undertake any activity related to ballistic missiles capable of delivering nuclear weapons, including launches using ballistic missile technology, and that states shall take necessary measures to prevent the transfer of technology or technical assistance to Iran related to such activities. This provision of UNSCR 1929 imposed a legal prohibition on Iran's ballistic missile activity. There was force of law behind those words. Nevertheless, Iran conducted multiple ballistic missile launches between 2010 and 2015 in flagrant violation of that resolution. So what did we do in response? Did we increase accountability in Iran for serial violations of international law? Quite the opposite. In fact, the level of accountability in Iran has diminished instead of decreased, while the risk has increased. In connection with the Iranian regime's engagement in nuclear talks and at the Obama administration's urging, the Security Council replaced Resolution 1929 with Resolution 2231. Resolution 2231 calls upon Iran not to undertake any activity related to ballistic missiles designed to be capable of delivering nuclear weapons. Notwithstanding that change in language, the world's concerns remain. When we collectively call upon Iran to cease its ballistic missile activity, we must agree to stop it now. But Iran is as defiant of the world's insistence as ever. Because here we are, for the 12th year in a row, meeting about Iran's ballistic missiles, addressing an incredibly problematic data set. Iran's pace of missile activity, including missile launches and tests, did not diminish since the JCPOA. In fact, Iran's missile testing and missile proliferation is growing. Today, Iran has the largest ballistic missile force in the Middle East. It has more than 10 ballistic missile systems in its inventory, or in development. It has hundreds of missiles which pose a threat to our partners in the region. From more recent times, in 2016, during the time of the JCPOA, Iran unveiled two new short-range ballistic missiles, which it claims are capable of striking targets between 500 and 700 kilometers. In January of 2017, during the time of the JCPOA, Iran launched a medium-range missile designed to carry a payload greater than 500 kilograms and which could be used to carry nuclear warheads. Its suspected range also approaches 2,000 kilometers, which is far enough to target Athens, Sofia, Bucharest, and other major European cities. If the IRGC airspace commander is telling the truth and Iran has capabilities beyond 2,000 kilometers, other European capitals are at risk as well. In July of 2017, while the United States was still in the JCPOA, Iran tested a Simorgh space launch vehicle. The United States, France, Germany, and the UK all assessed that the launch was inconsistent with 2231 because space launch vehicle use uses a similar technology as intercontinental ballistic missiles. Iran has exported ballistic missile systems as well, most recently to Yemen. We have hard evidence that Iran is providing missiles, training, and support to the Houthis, and the Iranian Houthi missile force is fully engaged. This poses a threat to innocent civilians, including Americans living in Riyadh, Abu Dhabi, Dubai, as well as people of all nationalities who travel on civilian aircraft in that region. Iran is also transferring ballistic missile systems to Shia militias in Iraq. And just look at the last 2 weeks. The Iranian regime test-fired a medium-range ballistic missile that is capable of carrying multiple warheads. Our goodwill gestures have been futile. Futile in correcting the Iranian regime's reckless missile activity and its destructive behaviors. No nation can dispute that Iran is in open defiance of UN Security Council Resolution 2231. The United States is not alone in raising these concerns. I'd like to thank France and Germany and the United Kingdom for raising concerns about Iranian missile proliferation to the Secretariat. I would also like to thank our partners from Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates who are working with UN inspectors in recovering material debris of Iranian-supplied missiles, rockets, and UAVs launched into their countries by Houthi forces in Yemen. Our Israeli allies have brought further evidence to the Security Council about Iran's continued launches of ballistic missiles that are inherently capable of carrying nuclear weapons. Israel has also given evidence to the Secretariat of Iran's transfer of weapon systems to its proxies all around the Middle East, and in defiance of what we have insisted that they do. So the question now, what steps ought we take to confront this Iranian malign activity? We risk the security of our people if Iran continues stocking up on ballistic missiles. We risk escalation of conflict in the region if we fail to restore deterrence. And we convey to all other malign actors that they too can defy the Security Council with impunity if we do nothing. The United Nations Charter, as you all know well, calls the primary bestows upon the Security Council the primary responsibility for the maintenance of international peace and security. We all take this responsibility seriously. The United States seeks to work with all other members of the Council to reimpose on Iran the ballistic missile restrictions outlined in 1929. Beyond addressing Iran's ballistic missile activities, the Council should not lift the arms embargo in 2020 on Iran. This is a country in noncompliance with multiple UN Security Council resolutions, including those related to Al-Qaeda, Afghanistan, Lebanon, Yemen, and Somalia. Iran is harboring Al-Qaeda, supporting Taliban militants in Afghanistan, arming terrorists in Lebanon, facilitating illicit trade in Somali charcoal benefiting al-Shabaab, and training and equipping Shia militias in Iraq, even as we sit here today. It is also stoking conflict in Syria and Yemen. The Council must address these malign activities. It cannot reward Iran by lifting the arms embargo. We also call on the Council to establish inspection and interdiction measures in ports and on the high seas to thwart Iran's continuing efforts to circumvent the existing arms restrictions. Some have questioned our decision to withdraw from the JCPOA. We reply that it is self-evident why we did so, based upon the very conversation we're having here today. Prior to the deal, Western leaders made grand claims of how the JCPOA would usher in a new era of moderation from the Iranian regime. Indeed, America's own president said, quote, ideally, we would see a situation in which Iran, seeing sanctions reduced, would start focusing on its economy, on training its people, on reentering the world community, to lessening its provocative activities in the region. But what do we actually see? The JCPOA has, without a doubt, to date, shielded the Islamic Republic of Iran from the accountability to the risks it presents to the world. The Iranian regime is pursuing the same destructive, revolutionary goals that it has for the past 39 years, except now it has more money to achieve them, thanks to the nuclear deal. I'm here today first and foremost in my capacity as the Secretary of State of the United States of America. Under President Trump, the security of our people and our allies comes first. But in the finest traditions of American leadership, the United States will continue to unite sovereign nations in their responsibility to work for the peace and security of their own people and a stable international order. The United States is going to continue to be relentless in building a coalition of responsible nations who are serious in confronting the Iranian regime's reckless ballistic missile activity. This includes the treatment of its own people as well. That type of malign activity is something that the United States will keep standing side by side with the people of Iran. They have been the worst victims of the regime for nearly 40 years, and they have the unwavering support of the United States. Finally, the Trump administration clearly defined in May the 12 areas in which we are demanding change from Iran. If Iran makes a fundamental strategic shift and honors these demands, we are prepared to ease our pressure campaign and support the modernization and reintegration of the Iranian economy into the international economic system. But relief from our efforts will come only when we see tangible, demonstrated, and sustained shifts in Tehran's policies. Thank you.
Pompeo's remarks were addressed by Iran's Deputy Representative Mehdi Danish Yadzi at the end of Wednesday's session.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Mr. President, distinguished colleagues, ambassadors, I would like to begin by sincerely thanking those council members who reaffirmed their commitment to continue supporting the JCPOA. At a time when multilateralism is under threat, preserving the JCPOA, which according to the United Nations Secretary General, is a demonstration of successful multilateralism and a major achievement in dialogue and diplomacy, is of utmost importance. From this perspective, we laud the call by distinguished Secretary General in his report that the JCPOA participants, the Council, all member states and regional and other international actors must ensure the continuity of this agreement that is fundamental to regional and international peace and security. In this meeting that is held to consider the implementation of Resolution 2231, the Council should therefore consider and address all obstacles created in its implementation, in particular, its provisions on promoting and facilitating the development of normal economic and trade contact and cooperation with Iran. As it is well known, the sustainability of the JCPOA has been seriously challenged by unilateral and unlawful conducts of the United States in withdrawing from the JCPOA and reimposing illegal sanctions against Iran. It is a clear violation of the resolution that calls upon all states without exception. All states without exception, which includes the United States, not only to take action as may be appropriate to support the implementation of the JCPOA, but also to refrain from action that undermine implementation of commitments under the JCPOA. Therefore, the Council should consider the United States' illegal acts as a flagrant violation of the resolution and hold it accountable for such violations. It is evident that any inaction or leniency in taking appropriate action to prevent the violation of resolution will only embolden the United States to continue its unlawful practices and irresponsible policies. The irony is that the United States, who itself is in absolute violation of the Resolution 2231, today accused Iran of violating this resolution. What we heard today was another series of lies, fabrication, disinformation, and deceptive statements by the United States. It is not unprecedented. Just recall in famous speeches made in the past at this very chamber by the United States officials. It is not surprising, too. Deception is an inseparable part of the United States foreign policy, as is bullying and its addiction to sanction and warmongering. A clear example of such policies in the American approach toward Iran's peaceful nuclear program, on which it manufactured an unnecessary crisis and were successful in abusing this counsel to impose illegal sanctions. Nevertheless, as soon as it was ended with the conclusion of the JCPOA, and the IAEA repeatedly confirmed Iran's full compliance with its commitment, the United States withdrew from the JCPOA, violated Resolution 2231, reimposed its illegal sanction, and started punishing states, who abide by the resolution. Such policies and practices clearly indicate that, even in the past, they did not have any genuine concern about Iran's nuclear program. Now, for the first time in the United Nations history, a permanent member of this Security Council is blatantly punishing United Nations member state not for violating, rather for complying with the Security Council resolution. That is the first time in the history of the Security Council. And yet, the U.S. finds the audacity to hijack the Council to intensify its hostilities against Iran. We have not forgotten the days when the United States has rendered this Council ineffective in preventing Saddam's aggression, stopping the use of chemical weapons against Iranian, as well as addressing the attacks to the Iranian civil aircraft over the Persian Gulf by the American forces, killing all 290 people on board, including 66 children. Rather than allowing the U.S. to repeat such abusive patterns, the Council should strongly condemn the U.S. for reimposing its illegal sanction against Iranian in violation of the United Nations Charter and international law. This sanction only harms the ordinary and, more importantly, vulnerable people of Iran, such as women, children, elderly, and patients. They prevent even the import of basic food, medicine, and medical devices to Iran. Unlike the U.S. declaration, in practice, there is no exception or exemption for importing such needs. Now, they argue that banks don't have confidence in Iran's banking system to facilitate those transactions. That's Iran's problem. It is not our problem. Isn't it ironic and disgraceful? How come they had confidence to Iran's banking system till weeks ago and suddenly and for no reason lost their confidence? In fact, they avoid such transactions because they are intimidated and threatened by a bullying and irresponsible state. On 7 November 2018, the United States Secretary of State threatened all Iranians to mass starvation. He said the Iranian, quote, leadership has to make a decision that they want their people to eat. That is the statement of the Secretary of State of the United States. Does weaponizing of food and medicine against civilians have any other designation than crime against humanity? Isn't the disruption of free trade and application of the United States national laws to other nations, thus disrespecting their sovereignty, a clear manifestation of economic terrorism? The international community should stand against American bullying policies, and the U.S. authorities should be held to account for ordering, committing, and enforcing such horrible crimes. Mr. President, through fabrication, disinformation, and invoking irrelevant criteria, the United States tries to create ambiguity and confusion in order to misinterpret the resolution with regard to Iran's missile launches. Here, I draw your attention to the interpretation of relevant paragraphs of the resolution by the U.S. Special Envoy on Iran, not by Iran, by the U.S. Special Envoy on Iran, who says that the resolution simply and kindly called upon Iran not to undertake certain activities. He then concludes that the resolution's language is hardly a clear and enforceable prohibition. Iran's ballistic missile program is designed to be exclusively capable of delivering conventional warheads required to deter foreign threats. While the Americans argue that Iran's security concerns are entirely self-generated, and also hypocritically state that Iran faces no natural threat from Israel. As recently as 3 months ago, its prime minister threatens Iran with even nuclear annihilation. That was the threat by Prime Minister of Israel. Definitely a wishful dream. Moreover, no one can ignore consistent, tremendous threats Iran continues to face from United States itself, in particular through its outdated mantra of all options are on the table, which means military threat. They are dreaming wishfully to move us back to those days when Saddam's planes bombed an Iranian city for 105 minutes, the longest aerial assault since World War II, killing and injuring over 1,000 civilians. They also wish to move us back to those days when Saddam was raining missiles on our cities, some of them carrying chemical component provided by the United States, and Iran was actively prevented from purchasing even the most rudimentary means of self-defense to at least deter the aggressor. Do not be surprised. They even prevented the export of barbed wire to Iran. Most of such restrictions still continue. We have paid a very high price to save our territory from the aggressors and to ensure the security of our borders and citizens. Those days have long passed. Living in such a volatile region as the Middle East, our government will not and cannot compromise on its security and its conventional defensive capability as no other country does. Describing Iran as a source of regional threat is nothing but a blame shift in order to sell more American beautiful weapons, as the United States President calls them. Conflict, insecurity, and instability in our region has two main sources, occupation of Palestine by Israel, and the American intervention and its massive military buildup in our region. Who can also forget the U.S. role, as openly confessed by its president during his campaign, in creating the ugliest face of terrorism, the monstrous ISIS? If it was not for Iran's support and help, the black flag of ISIS was still flying around the Middle East. Our neighboring countries repeatedly acknowledged and praised Iran's role in fighting and defeating Daesh in that country. In reaction to Iran's prominent role in fighting terrorist groups in Syria and Iraq, such groups have conducted a few terrorist attacks in Iran in 2017 and 2018, including in our parliament. Today, in addition to transferring ISIS elements to Afghanistan and Central Asian countries, the U.S. has extended its sponsorship of terrorism to a vicious terrorist cult, the MKO, Mujahideen Khalq, that has murdered more than 17,000 Iranians, including children, women, girls, officials, ordinary people, and many Iraqis also, and who currently cozy up to the highest political figures in Washington to destabilize Iran through terrorist activities. Here, Mr. President, I would like to stress that according to the Charter, this Council represents all member states. Thus, its decision should also echo their views. Almost all members of this organization have strongly supported the JCPOA and loudly voiced their rejection of the illegal unilateral sanction that is a clear violation of the Resolution 2231. Consequently, the Council should hold the U.S. accountable for reimposing such sanction and demand that the U.S. end their application. This also would be in line with the obligation imposed on the U.S. by the ICJ's order issued unanimously on 3rd October 2018, an order which is a clear testament to the illegality of the U.S. sanctions. I would also like to clarify that our legal and technical observation on the report of the Secretary General is contained in a letter that yesterday I have sent to Your Excellency. It also covered our views on issues that I did not address in my remarks today. I thank you, Mr. President.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Worlds Apart. From a riddle inside an enigma to a gas station masquerading as a country, the Western understanding of Russia, according to the Russians themselves, has long been void of understanding. Can the current crisis in relations between Russia and the West be put on this knowledge gap, or is it perhaps triggered by the two sides knowing each other all too well? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Hans Wilhelm Seinfeld, a Norwegian journalist and a veteran foreign correspondent to Moscow. Mr. Seinfeld, it's a pleasure talking to you. Thank you very much for receiving us in your house.
Thank you for coming.
Now, you've been stationed to Moscow for almost 20 years. You had four stints as a foreign correspondent there, the first one beginning in 1980, the last one ending in 2014. I'm sure a lot of things changed during that time, but what are some of the notable things that stayed the same?
So you mentioned Norway as a gas station.
Well, I meant Russia. That was actually...
We are equally big as a gas station in this country. However, before I became a journalist, I took equivalent to a PhD in Soviet history. And let me remind you that Norway is the neighbor state of Russia. We are the only neighbor that Russia has without ever being at war with Norway. The Russians as such are quite popular in Norway among the lay people.
Seriously, that is a surprising thing to hear, especially knowing that there are so many military exercises right off your
The Russians became close to us during the Second World War. They liberated northeast of Finnmark, that is our northmost county, Next year, in December next year, we are celebrating 75 years of that liberation. I am among those who advocate the necessity to invite Vladimir Putin, because the owner right to that bravery belongs to Russia. It cost you 2,000 soldiers' life, and we cannot make a symbolic act like that a hostage of contemporary conjectures.
You mentioned that the Russian Nuri have quite an extensive history, but as somebody who's spent a lot of time both in to the Soviet Union and to Russia, I want to get your perspective on how different these two geopolitical, or how similar these two geopolitical entities are. Because I interview a lot of people in the West, and they relate Russia and the Soviet, they think of Russia and the Soviet Union as one of the same. And I think to us as Russians, those are totally different periods.
Absolutely. I must confess that domestic policies in Russia or the Soviet Union always fascinated me more than the foreign policy. However, Russia today is not the Soviet Union. Our arguments against the Soviet Union, that was the Iron Curtain. It was the absence of the liberty of faith and the speech of freedom. Those three rights have been restored. The fear has disappeared from Russia. There are partly censorship here and there. Where is that not? Believe me. So it's unfair to say that Putin has restored the Soviet Union. There are so many publications. I have in my bookshelves 15 volumes of the weekly reports from KGB to Stalin from 26 to 34 about everything that happened in the Soviet society. So much has been published in post-communist Russia that only idiots can believe there is a way back and no one wants it.
Now, you mentioned Putin's name, and you had your introduction to that man long before many other people did, because I read somewhere that you were served coffee by him when he was still deputy mayor, or perhaps even an assistant to the mayor of St. Petersburg administration. What was so memorable about that event that made you remember? Why would you keep that in mind?
His boss, the man who introduced both Vladimir Putin and Dmitry Medvedev to politics, was Lord Mayor Anatoly Sobchak. He was my friend. And people have to remember, after the putsch, the coup d'etat in 1991, 19th of August, Sobchak became the second most popular leader after Boris Yeltsin. And that's when I meet Putin the first time. I had been publishing a book. It was called A Return to Europe, about Russia. And I gave it to Sobchak in Smolny, where Lenin was in charge of the October Revolution. And we were sitting, bickering a bit about freedom in Russia. And I said, Anatoly Alexandrovich, you have to remove Lenin in front of the Smolny Palace. And he said, no, that's our history. He will stay. When we were sitting like that, the chief of administration came in pouring coffee. That was Vladimir Putin.
Did he join the conversation?
Yes. And in the front office, who was sitting there watching the front desk? That was his assistant, Dmitry Medvedev. And my point is that one of the leading Democrats in post-communist Russia, he was the mentor of Vladimir Putin and Dmitry Medvedev. And Putin delivered his commission as a major of KGB. In the middle of the coup in 1991, Putin, at the most crucial points of Russian post-communist history, sided with democracy 19th of August 1991.
When Western journalists write about Putin or contemporary Russia, they never fail to mention that Putin had a KGB experience, but they almost never mention his experience at the St. Petersburg administration, the first democratic city administration in that country, or that he was, for example, a personal friend of the Solzhenitsyn family. Why do you think those connections, the connections that he had and the associations that he had after KGB, don't matter to Western colleagues?
Because they know Russia poorly. As I mentioned to you, domestic relationships in Russia fascinate me to this day, much more than foreign policy. And Putin, he was publishing a very interesting book in the spring of 2000, A Первого Человека, from the first man of the state. And there he is describing his period as a KGB major in Dresden, East Germany, in the autumn of 89, weeks before the downfall of the Berlin Wall. And he writes in that book that we were sitting in the KGB Residentura in Dresden, burning secret documents until the oven went to hell. And he said, we didn't quite understand what happened in East Germany, but we did have a feeling that the Soviet Union was mortally ill. It was called the paralysis of government.
One of the most quoted and misquoted sayings of Putin is that the collapse of the Soviet Union was one of the greatest tragedies of the 20th century. You saw that in real time. You were stationed in Russia back then. What was it like for you, that experience of the whole universe, I suppose, collapsing?
It came very abruptly. But I understood that Gorbachev was finished because of the putsch. It was his closest people who committed this. I was inside the White House with Boris Yeltsin covering this from the Yeltsin side. So we did understand already in August that something was going very, very wrong for Mikhail Gorbachev, and Yeltsin was the winner. And this, he was the popular elected president of the Russian Soviet Republic. But we knew there would come problems because, say, economy. The Soviet economy was more integrated than in the European Union. And, of course, these problems came. And the 1930s, I will not repeat that here, but I will quote the Patriarch Kirill II, who said the 1990s of Russian history is among the worst episodes in contemporary Russian history. You had a loss of population in the 1990s, bordering to 10 million men, according to the president of the Medical Union of Russia, Pokrovsky, in 2001. 10 million men vanished. Either they were not born or they died prematurely. So what happened in the 1990s to a large degree discredited the tapestry of modern democracy. And you have a nice way of saying it in Russian. You call the privatizatsiya, the privatization. You call it prihvatizatsiya. I have translated that into English. It wasn't a privatization, but a piratization of your economy.
Yeah, it was a very traumatic time. And I was a very young teenager at the time. And the things that I remember most vividly are not the lines, not the shortages, but the collapse of coordinates for good and evil. You know, the role models that we had before were discredited, and the new role models were not that clear. Do you think Russia has overcome that collapse of the core belief system, or is it still searching for
something? No, but be fair to Russia. The Soviet Union collapses. Out with Lenin, in with the church. But you get two vacuum effects in Russia after 91. The vacuum of laws takes 15 years to restore contemporary law. The penal code was from 1957. There was no paragraph defending private property, for instance. But more important, you get a vacuum of values. You have to find new idols, new ideals. It took 20 years before Putin restored the Codex of Tsar Nikolai II for officers, for instance. So this vacuum effect, in a philosophical way, became a huge hindrance. And after all, Russia has 1,000 years political history. You've had a democracy, more or less, for 26 years. And everything connected to the contemporary postmodern world was a novelty, a new thing for Russians. You had to develop a state without institutions from 1992.
Yeah, I always think about it as a person who had a stroke, who had to relearn how to walk, how to talk, how to think, how to function. Anyway, we have to take a very short break now, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with a prominent Norwegian journalist, Hans Wilhelm Seinfeld. Mr. Seinfeld, before the break, we were talking about this collapse of the worldview that the Russians experienced in the early 1990s. And there are some people in Russia who argue that the West is now going through a milder version of that, when a familiar world, things that you used to believe or used to take for granted, are now being questioned. And some would suggest that it comes as a result of the West's own policies, pretty much like it happened to the Soviet Union, because the Soviet Union wasn't destroyed by the West. It collapsed under its own contradictions. Do you agree with that?
Let me wrap up the Soviet experience, because in April 1991, Rich Nixon came to Boris Yeltsin. I was present. And Nixon said an important thing, emphasizing the omitting of an opportunity by the West in 1991, 1992. Nixon said, he was an American president, we spent trillions of American dollars on containment against the aggressive Soviet communism. We were not willing to ensure the young and frail Russian democracy with a few tens billion of dollars. It was $80 billion, which was the foreign debt of the Soviet Union. Had the West, when Russia was on its knees, paid away those debts instead of this Paris Club, then we would have been a catalysator of economic growth, and the 90s might have been happier.
But at the end, the Russians did pay that debt all by themselves.
Yeah.
And that certainly didn't make the 90s easier. But I think Russia has been progressing as best as it can towards a more stable system. You've been very critical of the Russian democratic institutions. You suggested that perhaps Russians are too paternalistic, they are too submissive to the authority. Is that still your view? Do you think Russians are still failing when it comes to building their institutions?
I've not been so critical against the constitution that was written by Anatoly Sobchak. However, I remind you that when Vladimir Putin returned for the third time, he made the speech, State of the Union, at 12 o'clock, the 12th December 2012 in the Kremlin. And he said, if we do not soon do something for those between 20 and 45, that means building lodging facilities, houses, Russia as a federal state may fall apart in 15 to 20 years, as did the Soviet Union. What fails in Russia's economic policies is distribution of wealth. You have not this feature in your economy, distribution of wealth. That is why the privatization of the 90s became a big, big tragedy for Russia.
Can I still take you back to my first question about the West reconsidering its values? Because the argument is that the Cold War didn't actually end in 1991. It is only ending now, and not with collapse of one system, but also with the crumbling of another system. That's an extreme message for some in the West. Do you agree with that or not?
No, I do not think the West is about to collapse. I definitely agree that in Western Europe now, you have the biggest political leadership crisis since 1939. And we have a narcissist in the White House. We have Putin in the Kremlin. It's not the best of situations. A very good friend of mine, whom you know well in Moscow, Leduv Namtvedt, he resigned as Moscow ambassador after 5 years in September. And he says, we went to school together, that now relationships have been so ruined that the bureaucracies will not be able to restore the relationship on the East-West axis if the politicians do not sit down, start talking, and agree to agree. That is exactly what Ronald Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev did.
Yeah, but you know that's not going to happen. And I'm sorry for being so persistent, because as a former war correspondent, I know that you also covered many conflicts. The war in Afghanistan was thought to bring the end to the Soviet Union. It made many people within the Soviet Union to question its moral foundations. Didn't the war in Libya play exactly the same role for the West? Because it did engineer, it did produce the migration crisis that definitely energized the opposition to the liberal world order in theirs. It may not have collapsed, but it has been undermined.
I don't see it quite as a parallel, because the Afghani war between 79 and 89 was much more traumatic for the Soviet Union than the Middle East has been for the West. But I do agree that the facets, the answer to the treatment of Iraq and Syria, you can observe in Southeast Turkey, 3 million refugees, definitely. But it doesn't shake the Western system. The Western system and the European Union is definitely pressed by the migration, but they have bigger problems like that. Brexit, for one thing. They have nationalism in Poland, in Hungary. So the test on the European Union now is a very, very sinister one.
We mentioned many differences that Russia and the West have, but I think the biggest one is Ukraine. And you said on a number of occasions that the West, including Norway, can't fail Ukraine. What do you mean by that?
Let me take you back to the Saturday, 8 December 1991, in the village of Bielawieskaya Pushchina. That's where the Soviet Union formally is closed down by Boris Yeltsin, Stanislav Shushkevich, and Leonid Kravchuk. Kravchuk had been elected a week earlier as the Ukrainian president. He was telling us in 2014 only that he had been sitting there waiting for Boris Yeltsin to say, "We Russians want to take with us the Crimea Peninsula." Had Yeltsin said so, Kravchuk would have said, "Of course, Comrade Yeltsin." But in the afternoon, Yeltsin got tipsy and forgot about the whole Crimea. In January 92, I was in Sevastopol. People, as you say in Russian, Vagnevye, they were outrageously mad at Yeltsin because he forgot it.
This is an important point about Sevastopol. You said that in one of your interviews that Russia's actions in Crimea were triggered by the fears that NATO ships would be
Putin
there.
Has said so himself.
I mean, seeing the kind of politics that Ukraine has right now, do you think those fears were justified?
You know, I think we have to understand one important thing, and that is the approach to the sanctions stemming from the annexation of the Crimea. In 1992, Russia's president Boris Yeltsin asked for enlargements of the Helsinki Treaty of 75. It was the treaty guaranteeing the post-war borders in Europe. Yeltsin asked that this mandate be enlarged also to be valid for the borders between the formerly Soviet republics, 15 countries. This was done. It was ratified also by Russia. So by going in and taking over the Crimea in 2014, Russia broke international law. Russia could have got to Crimea without weapons, because 70% of the population on the Crimea, they're Russians. No one disputes that.
But with all due respect, I mean, there are people in Russia who agree that Russia broke the international law. But
that's indisputable.
But in this world, everybody breaks international law. So you cannot demand one single country to uphold it when everybody else, including Russia's main rivals, are doing the same.
I would quote Mikhail Gorbachev's last book, Astayus Optimistum, I Remain an Optimist. He writes that the only solution to the conflict with Ukraine is the fulfilling of the Minsk II diplomatic process. Russia has been failing to do that because the pro-Russian separatists in southeast Ukraine should be cooled down. There are 10,000 lives lost. My point is that in doing what Putin did in 2014, many people, and notably all the Western countries, think that he rehabilitated the Brezhnev doctrine defending the invasion of Czechoslovakia 21st of August 1961.
Do you think that was why he did it?
I think that Putin felt an infringement, that the NATO enlargement again towards the east infringed Russia. However, yes, I do think that the Russians panicked, because I was in Kiev. I broke off my coverage of the Olympic Games in Sochi, going to Kiev, the bloodbath, 90 people were killed by Berkut, the special
police. Well, we don't know at this point who actually killed them.
I was there. I saw where the snipers were. They were on the roof of the government. And on Thursday, 20th of February, 2014, I counted 50 people killed in front of my camera.
I'm an eyewitness. I was also there.
Did you count 50 people dead in front of your camera? I did. Then the mood changed in the Ukraine. Prior to this, the majority of the Ukrainians, they were against NATO membership. After this killing, 90 people killed in 1 week. It switched.
We don't know who sent those snipers there and whose orders they were. Well, I think even in Ukraine, the investigation is still ongoing. It's not conclusive. It's been 5 years after Ukraine. You've been there. I've been there. I think we can agree that most of the aspirations that people had on the Maidan Square at that time haven't been fulfilled, except for cutting ties with Russia.
Yeah, but there was Russian failures in propaganda too, because the Russians, they claimed.
It's not about the Russians. I mean, whatever Russians do did not influence the Ukraine
domestic
politics. Yeah, but Russia
claims that fascism is today in the Ukraine. The carrier of the alleged fascism was Pravi sector, the rightist sector. They got 0.61 percentages during the presidential elections in the Ukraine in 2014.
But there are lots of nationalists, ultra-nationalists in Ukraine. You would not argue with that.
As in Russia. However, you cannot fail to see two aspects of the conflict between Russia and the Ukraine. Firstly, it's a tragedy. Imagine all these millions where mommy is Ukrainian and daddy is Russian.
Like,
it's schizophrenic.
Like me. And just the other day, Ukrainian president, not just the right sector, but the Ukrainian presidency banned all Russians from visiting their relatives in Ukraine.
They've done that earlier too.
That order was still in force. You've been critical of Russia. You noted the Russia's missteps. Do you think that a country that wants to be part of the European Union should respond to a naval altercation by banning the entire population of another country? Is that democratic? Is that in line with Western values?
Firstly, you have to understand that the skirmishes in the Kerch Sound, where Russia took three naval vessels, is a military act. It must be brought to a clear ending the understanding of what happened.
Absolutely.
But the point is that there is a war by proxy between Ukraine and Russia in the southeast, in Donetsk and Lugansk.
Banning the entire population of another country is a proportionate action to that?
No, it's not. However, these things happen when there is no dialogue. That's why I support Gorbachev, who says that the only solution is to get back to the conference table and negotiate a controlled ceasefire, perimedia, in southeast Ukraine. If not, this will continue.
Is there any appetite for that in Kiev? You as a journalist, do you think the Kiev authorities are open to that?
I think by his policies, Putin alienated 40 million Ukrainians.
This is not what I asked you. You said that we need to go back to the Minsk agreements. When the Minsk agreements were signed,
Of the alienation, I do not think it is a big appetite. However, there is as much to criticize on domestic affairs in the Ukraine as it is in Russia. You Slavs are very similar, and you are experts on quarreling, and you quarrel well now. However, it is a situation that is unpredictable, and that is why it's dangerous. I think both Russia and Ukraine need to understand that they need assistance now in order to re-establish a dialogue. There are a lot of things to talk about, and that is why I reminded you that at the peak of the Cold War, Ronald Reagan and Gorbachev sat down, and Gorbachev, he even said, as the first sentence of Perestroika, reconstruction, we cannot continue to live like this.
Well,
I repeat his words today. We cannot continue to live like this.
Well, Mr. Seinfeld, we cannot continue to talk like that because our time is up, but I really appreciate your candor today and your time with us. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I encourage our viewers to keep this conversation going on our social media pages and hope to see you again, same place, same time, here on Worlds Apart.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.